Chapter 37, The Afterburn. It felt good to be home, but also weird. I was thinking that I liked the place, but also that it made no sense for me to stay. Just like I had passed through so many places on my trip, I also had to pass through this one at some point. Change the scene, live a different life, seek adventure. Staying and living in that one place for the rest of my life would be contrary to everything I'd learned on the trip. Life, friends, and good experiences are everywhere in the world, just waiting to be discovered. I started to get bored after 3 or 4 days at home in Copenhagen. I knew I would have to stay, but my brain was hardwired to think something else. I was still in travel mode and ready to move on to the next place. I panicked a little bit and began making plans for how to keep up my pace. First was the training. I had learned so much from rolling with different people around the world that it would make zero sense to stop there and just roll with the guys in my gym again. I got in touch with people from gyms around town and arranged to train with them. I changed my regular Friday class to be a 2.5 hour long open mat session, inviting everyone from any gym to come roll with us for free. Had I done the same a year earlier, I would probably have been a bit afraid that I would lose some team members who might become friends with people from other gyms. The thought didn't even cross my mind at that point, and the Friday sessions rapidly became a big success with 30-40 people from all over town on the mat every week. I had renewed energy and inspiration to teach again, and every class I did, I tried to pass as many of my new experiences on to people as possible. I had the same passion for training as a beginner who had just started and got hooked. In a way, I felt like I had just rediscovered jiu-jitsu for myself, stepping into a completely new era of my career on the mat. Getting back into competition was suddenly the most natural thing for me to do. The confidence in my game was at an all-time high, and I knew that the best way to keep improving and inspiring those I was teaching would be to step onto the mat and test myself again and again. To me, it was still just a feeling like going to other gyms and rolling with people I didn't know. I set up a team of guys for the tournaments that I had filled the calendar hanging on the wall of my little office in the gym. It was a very busy schedule, and I had ambitiously written down all the events I could find in Europe. I wanted to push myself as much as I could to get out into deep water and learn to swim. We flew to Switzerland and competed in beautiful Geneva. The Sundbath Alps were right outside our doorstep and I was eager to go for a walk on them, but the competition organizers were a bit slow, so we ended up spending all our time in the sports hall instead. I lost the first match in my weight division, but ended up taking gold in the open weight division. In London, more than 10 guys joined me for the IBJJF London Open. A loss to the sneaky inverted De La Hiva game inspired me to study it in detail in order to fill that gap in my game. Paris hosted the second European knockout tournament, where I won the belt in the expert division, beating a black belt in my first match and then winning the finale by heel hook. It was a special city to me since it was the first destination of my trip. Standing by the Eiffel Tower, I remembered the rainy night I had been in the same spot, full of expectations and excitement for how my life would look 6 months later. At the Scandinavian Open, I lost a close match to a tough Finnish guy and took home a swollen left testicle from a single leg attempt gone wrong. Spending a week in Scotland, I drove mountain bikes around the Highlands on the warmest day of the year, won 2 gold medals at the Glasgow Open, and taught a seminar at Daniel from Taiwan's gym in Edinburgh. For my last trip of the year, I filled the bus with 45 people from my gym and drove 5 hours up in Sweden for the Swedish Open, one of Europe's biggest competitions. We took home 17 medals and got the trophy for the best kids team, finally beating that gym who had won it 5 years in a row. My crazy burst of competitions had totaled 67 medals in 2 months for me and my students. It was a fast-paced autumn. All the short trips and many tournaments blurred together. I still didn't feel like I'd arrived home. My mind was flowing in a state of traveling freedom. The pace of the many things happening were as hectic as the trip itself. People from all over the world came to visit, and it seemed like we had a new guy coming through the door every week. Fernando, one of the guys from Costa Rica, stayed for a few months. Aaron from Turkey joined us for a bus trip to the competition in Sweden, and Mario, the passionate guy with the hammock from the Galapagos Islands, kept his promise and stayed with me for 3 weeks. I constantly had someone coming or leaving. If I couldn't get to the world, at least I would make it come to me for a while. I might have returned home from my travels, but I had hit the ground running, and it must have been strange for people around me to observe me in that period. I had changed on the inside and outside, as if it was a different person that had come home. I looked different, having lost a lot of weight on the trip, and was still without a haircut for half a year. While I occasionally found myself sitting on my couch at home, having a break, thoughts and ideas in my head were constantly racing each other. I saw a movie about a guy who took a pill and could suddenly use his entire brain to see the grand scheme of life and the world. The movie itself wasn't really that good, but while I certainly couldn't write a book in one night, I definitely identified with the feeling. The movie itself wasn't really that good, but while I certainly couldn't write a book in one night, I definitely identified with the feeling. I could see the big picture. There was a mission with my life. Not a second could go to waste. I was chasing that feeling of ultimate freedom and being that raw version of myself. And exactly like during the trip, I found it in creating experiences for myself in a hectic pace. Anything I could do to get a small kick with the drug of life counted, and the more I could cram into a small period of time, the better. Apart from traveling to basically every competition I could find around Europe, I was on the mat 6 days a week, got myself a surfboard and went surfing north of Copenhagen, skimboarded every sunny day on the beach, took long evening rides through the streets of my neighborhood on a longboard, stayed up late to write my book every night, bought a guitar and practiced playing every morning, coordinated geek donations for poor kids around the world, worked on programming another website, took my mountain bike to the forest, started a business selling jiu-jitsu t-shirts, and went partying with my friends from the gym every single weekend the whole summer. The rest of the world was functioning at a completely different and much slower pace. Explaining my frantic pace and energetic state of mind to anyone was impossible. While I had been away for the experience of a lifetime, returning home with an afterburn that would make any space rocket engineer at NASA envious, everyone else had been living their usual slow-paced life of working 5 days a week, buying groceries, and feeding their cats. Most people around me seemed like strangers. We lived in parallel universes. I loved for anyone to jump aboard my train and tack along, but I had no time to stop and try to pick them up. I didn't seem to care about anything at all. All I could think was that my life could end the next day, and the world was still full of things to experience. Pulling my bicycle out of the basement, unshaven, wearing my Jiggy Jig hat, a colorful surfing t-shirt, and a skimboard under my arm on the way to the beach in the morning with the sun in my eyes, made me so happy inside that nothing else could possibly matter. Even though the weather guys on TV said it was the worst one in 30 years, I had the summer of my life. Like with jiu-jitsu, where through years of training, I had opened a fat, wide, high-speed connection to my brain that analyzed and processed terabytes of chess-like information about positions and strategies in every split second of a match, I felt like I'd similarly opened the hatch to life itself. Feelings, emotions, and impressions were overwhelming me, and my existence in the universe felt like it had more meaning than ever. I lived my life like a boss, thrusting forward at 100 miles per hour and enjoying every second of it. If I had come home to a 9-to-5 office job after the trip, it would have been pure hell for me. Looking at the video interview from Brazil, I remembered the feeling of freedom I had, sitting in that garden in the sun. It was still inside of me. I was clinging on to it, at least for a bit longer. When we finally got to January, the competition team had taken a big hit. Lots of injuries, financial problems, and cruel bosses not allowing time off work had cut us down to only 7 people going to Portugal for the Europeans. It didn't matter. We were ready. The competition streak in the fall had made me feel extremely confident in myself and my jiu-jitsu. I was better than ever and knew I stood a chance against anyone in my division. The fear of competing, the personality of someone who was never sure if he could perform at the high level or not, was long lost, dissolved by the many times I'd pushed myself to step on the mat and just do it. I had become a competitor, one of those very guys I used to admire. I looked at the matches going on around the mats. I could beat those people. There were still no signs of a desire to win, but watching the other brown belts compete, they were doing nothing I hadn't been exposed to in the gyms around the world already. Even more interesting, I realized that they didn't seem intimidating to me at all. A year earlier, at the same competition, I had looked at the guys on the mats and in the warm-up area. They all looked like they were some kind of superhumans who possessed a secret knowledge or skill that I didn't. Observing them, I didn't see actual people, but rather dark, blurry silhouette shadows representing everything I feared about competing. I couldn't tell them apart, like a uniformed army without individuals. Now, they looked like normal people, like any of the hundreds and hundreds of guys I had met in gyms around the world. I could see how one of them was the funny guy who always jokes around after class. Another one was the tough one, never giving young white belts a chance in sparring. There was the athletic, talented guy, the one owning 20 different gis, and the geek who could entertain himself in details of an omoplata sweep for half a year. They were all there, and there were no superhuman aliens. Okay, maybe a few, but most were just regular guys like myself. It became obvious to me that training with so many different people around the world, pushing myself through the fears of traveling, sparring, humiliation, and being a stranger in 56 gyms all over the world had paid off. The outer layers of the opponents that my brain had created were peeled away, and as I looked around, I suddenly found myself in a sports hall in Portugal, together with 2,500 potential new friends. The year before, they had merely been mirrors, reflections of my own fear. There had never really been any other competition than myself. The enemy was the inner me, and stepping onto the mat for the first match of the brown belt division at the European Championships 2012 was a very different Christian to the one competing in 2011. My skills had greatly improved. I had nothing to prove and no fear of either failing or of what my opponent was capable of. It was an emotionless cocktail that really proved to bring out the best in me when it was time to step up and perform at the highest level. The referee signaled for the match to begin and I clapped hands with my opponent. He looked around my size and probably hadn't cut any weight either. He was German and I had just witnessed him win his first match by a beautiful armbar. I felt like I was in pretty good shape and strong in all areas of my game, so I really didn't have a set game plan for the competition. However, the warm-up hadn't been really thorough, so to start out nice and easy, I decided to pull guard on him right away. As I had him in my open guard, my legs took over on autopilot and searched for holds, frame, blocks, and hooks. All I had to do was to mentally lean back and let the intuition of my guard, the sum of all its experiences, good and bad, take over. I felt like it was a living organism on its own. A small hand placement mistake made by my opponent, too small for either of us to consciously notice, was immediately taken advantage of, and before I knew it, I had my legs wrapped around his arm and neck for a triangle choke. The rest of the work to close it in was on me. As he tried to pull out, I closed an inverted triangle and waited for him to relax before I changed it to a regular one. My breathing was calm and my mind was emotionless, concentrating on playing my moves right and not get excited or rushing anything. As he stood up to escape, I grabbed my shin and underhooked his leg, rotating around him to tighten the choke around his neck. He tapped out. I heard my teammates cheer and clap behind me. It had taken less than a minute and I had moved on to the next round. It was the perfect warm-up. My opponent complimented my guard and said he would cheer for me as we shook hands and I thanked him for the match. Next up was a Danish guy from one of the other gyms in Copenhagen. I had known him for 10 years and knew that he would be a very tough guy to beat. His style of passing fitted my guard really badly and his closed guard looked like the gates of hell, so I didn't really have a clear plan for what position I would try to beat him in. With no plan, he had the initiative and pulled me into his closed guard. His legs were powerful and I had to use all my strength to keep my posture. He had cut a lot of weight for the tournament and was much stronger than me, I felt. He tried everything but didn't manage to either sweep nor submit me. On the other hand, I didn't feel like I could pass his guard either and was only semi-successful with one attempt. Eventually, I realized that my way to win would be to ride out the storm and hope for the referee's decision. I was on top and had a single guard pass attempt. If nothing else happened, I would probably get the win. At one point, his closed guard was tightly wrapped around my arms, head, and one leg. I couldn't move an inch and my muscles were stretched to the limit. All the defensive training I had done on my trip paid off as I managed to keep calm and wait for my opportunity to get out. Time ran out. I did it. The referee raised my hand and I had moved on to the final with the smallest possible margin for a win. At the highest level, even the smallest factor can determine the outcome of a match. It wasn't the most exciting win, but I played the game and made it through. I hadn't had a chance to watch the guy I was meeting in the final before the match. He was shorter than me and looked much stronger. With a 5-month-long shoulder injury, I hadn't been able to do any weightlifting since I got home from the trip and was still skinny and weak. My mind was sharp though, and I was determined to try and beat the guy. Unfortunately, he outpowered me. I threw everything at him, every single one of my best sweep attempts, but he was like a rock. He didn't move a bit. Whenever I went for something, he just flexed his muscles and stayed exactly where he was. Eventually, he got a grip of my belt and ankle. There was no way I could break it and had to let him pass my guard. He pinned me in side control like I had never been pinned before. He wouldn't give me an inch of space to move on. I kept my head calm and at the right moment escaped back to the guard. I ended up getting a deep half-guard sweep on him and was just about to get up and jump for a guard pass when the time ran out. I had lost the finale by points and gotten a silver medal at the European Championships. It was the biggest result our little team had ever produced, but it didn't really do anything for me. As I stood on the podium, I felt the same as if I had lost my first match. I couldn't get myself to be bothered about it. All I was thinking about was what I needed to work on to beat that guy next time. The ability I had developed as a child to close off emotions and focus on the task ahead of me had an interesting effect on my adult competition life. It was nice when I needed to perform without being affected by anger or fear, but when I finally achieved something, I missed a little bit of wild cheering and running around with my hands up. After the Europeans, about half a year after I'd gotten back home, things eventually started to slow down a bit. A shoulder injury combined with the cold Scandinavian winter put a dampener on all the activities I had done during the summer, and I could dedicate more of my mind to working on developing my gym. I was still being issued daily speeding tickets on my newly built superhighway of life, but the drug was beginning to lose its effect, and I probably started to seem more normal to people around me. I was getting into a regular rhythm of training and teaching and spent a lot of time writing my book. My promise to myself of trying to learn new languages made me concentrate on getting better at Swedish, and when three deaf kids joined my jiu-jitsu team, I started putting a lot of effort into learning sign language. I hadn't thought the day would come, but eventually I got a little tired of traveling so much and so often. Just like the way tropical beaches had gotten less and less interesting over my period of discovering them, traveling in itself needed to be more extreme and less often for me to really enjoy it. I decided to have a more spacious calendar for the spring of 2012 and only settled on a few snowboard trips to Sweden and a handful of travels that I found too interesting to miss out on. The guys from Chișinău in Moldova had really gotten started with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and invited me back to do a seminar for almost 100 people. I might use a few dirty tricks on you, 100 plus kilo Sambo guys there told me, sporting a Russian accent that any evil scientist would envy. His face looked like he had been working as a blacksmith since he was a baby. I had no choice but to tap him with a body triangle from back mount and a face crank after a minute and a half of him trying to drill his elbows into my rib cage. It was the coldest time of the year and coldest winter in 10 years when I visited Moscow. It was cruel, but I loved the contrast. The silhouettes of tall, wide brick palaces and building cranes looked like evil robots watching over the city. Smoke from the chimney of a power plant filled half the sky and blocked out most of the sunlight during the day. Every building was the same color, gray and dirty, like snow mixed with exhaust smoke from old cars. Abandoned warehouses and whole apartment blocks with no windows or walls were lit up by a rare ray of sunlight. Ice-cold wind blew right through them, as if they were stadium-sized concrete ventilation shafts from an apocalyptic future. Identical buildings lined up as far as the eye could see, holding apartments for tens of thousands of people, looked more like concrete prisons than someone's home. It was far from warm and exotic, but extreme travel experiences like these were the only thing left that could satisfy my vampire-like lust for blood of adventure. After the crazy competition race in the fall and the milestone performance at the Europeans, I started to reach a point in my training where I felt like everything was really coming together for me. My knee was feeling surprisingly fine and I was able to train a lot. My jiu-jitsu had reached a level where I was observing my body performing it more than consciously doing it. I didn't think about how I had to move anymore. When I rolled, I would find a place of peace in my mind, sit back, relax, and just look at my physical body doing everything it needed to. The best comparison I can think of would be tying shoelaces. It is something we probably all are black belts in. If we try to explain exactly how we tie the knot on our shoelaces, it is too difficult for us. It becomes even more obvious if we observe ourselves doing it. It is almost magic seeing the fingers work the laces in a complicated, expert fashion without consciously being able to tell what is going on. That's when I knew it was about time. The black belt. Already when I was on the road, Kari had warned me that Hobson was planning on getting me a black belt when I got home. I didn't want it at that time. The trip had matured me a lot, but I didn't feel like I was ready for that level just yet. My conditioning was terrible from all the traveling and lack of physical training, and also I wanted to give the all-time high confidence in my game a chance at competing with the brown belts, where I, as opposed to the black belt division, would stand an actual chance of winning something. In the spring, things were different. I had somehow digested the many impressions, inputs, and experiences from around the world. The competition season was over, and I'd had some really good results all around Europe. Things were settling down in my head and body. I could see the big picture of life and jiu-jitsu, and I felt like my game was at an all-time high. Hobson came by for training one day and made sure I knew that he wanted me to come to the training camp and meet his trainer from Brazil. It was no secret what he meant. Hobson was a first-degree black belt and couldn't give out one himself yet. I had always imagined that my black belt would come as a surprise out of the blue one day, but now I was somehow put in a situation where I could choose to go and get it or not. Of course, there were no guarantees. Edson would, without a doubt, thoroughly inspect my game, skills, and personality before deciding to go with Hobson's recommendation or not. I told him I would be there. I wanted to just enjoy the training at the camp, but it was difficult to not think about the graduation. My thoughts were at war with themselves. One side wanting to finally achieve a black belt after 23 years of training, the other furiously denying to take on the pressure and responsibilities that came along with it. Was I even good enough to be a superhuman black belt? I just felt like a regular guy with no special talent for the sport other than an ability to stick with it. I was trying hard to ignore the battle inside of my head and focus on the training itself. It was a long weekend of training and my body felt like it had been hit by a truck by the end of it. About 10 black belts were teaching for 8 hours a day. I had made a big mistake of rolling hard for 2 hours the day before the camp, and I could feel it in every muscle. Edson asked me to show a technique to everyone. In lack of instructors, I had been teaching jiu-jitsu for 13 years at that point. Since I was a white belt, teaching had been my way of learning the art myself. I felt completely at home trying to explain the basics of wrestling sweeps from the guard and was so indulged in getting the message across to the attendees that I almost forgot it wasn't me who was running the camp. We lined up and Edson asked me and three other brown belts to come to the front. He gave a small speech about the importance of both skill level and personality for becoming a black belt and asked Hobson to give me mine. He tied it around my waist and gave me a big hug. Everyone clapped for what seemed like an eternity. Some of the other guys with their new belts had tears in their eyes. Through my entire career in Jiu-Jitsu, I'd expected to be overwhelmed with emotions when I got my black belt, but I didn't feel much. Like in competitions, my mind was clear and I was focused on the goal. There was no adrenaline, no emotions in the way. All I could think about was the future. I was already planning the work needed to become the best possible athlete, teacher, and role model, thinking about what I needed to do to be able to compete at the highest level and how this final exam of my Jiu-Jitsu education would open up an endless flow of new opportunities. I'd just gotten my ticket to the ultimate roller coaster of life and was standing first in line, getting ready to ride it. The rest of the ceremony is blurry in my memory. Everyone congratulated me, but my thoughts were somewhere else. There was no time to cry or get excited. I had work to do. I got ready for my first rounds of sparring with my new belt and told Hobson I'd let him have the first dance. Over the years, I thought I'd started to figure out his game a little bit and was able to handle myself against him pretty well. I had rolled with him numerous times in the gym and felt like I was catching up with the little avid competitor. I was wrong. To celebrate my new promotion, he turned up the pace to competition speed and ran over me like a steam train, flipping me upside down like a pancake, judo tossing me like a bag of potatoes, and submitting me left and right. I had nothing on the curly, smiling lightweight from the poor upbringing in Bahia's favelas. As the timer rang and I sat on the mat trying to get myself together, I knew exactly what newly promoted black belts meant when they say they feel like white belts again. Competition was going to be tougher than ever, mentally and physically. I was at the bottom of the food chain now, having to fight for my survival against primates that had already evolved many generations ahead of me. The effort, sweat, tears, and pain I had gone through to reach black belt seemed like nothing compared to what lay ahead of me. I stood at the gate of my new life, a completely new level of suffering and hard work. There was no turning back. On the train on the way home from Sweden, I took a photo of my new belt and sent it to my father. One of the things I remembered most vividly from my childhood was my dream of one day becoming a black belt, just like him. I started the journey at the age of 7 and somehow strayed away from it for some years along the way. But there I was, standing on the finish line. The quest had defined me. My father was a young man in the early 70s when he stood in the reception of the first karate school in the country and signed up for his very first class. No one had even considered my existence at that point, but the moment he wrote his name on that photocopied form in his beautiful handwriting, he instantly changed the course of my life forever, giving me opportunities and experiences he could never in his wildest dreams imagine. My phone rang. "I am very, very proud of you," he said.